Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here today. I'd like to say thank you to Cody and Mr. Petrie for taking care of Cody Nalsinger. thank you for being here. Byron Dawson's in the audience here. And Walker's back here. He's back here hiding, leaning left and right. Go watch him. But no, thank you all for being here, Judge Gilman. And we appreciate everyone being here, and I hope everyone got plenty of questions. I know Cody's got a few there already lined up. He's going to emcee it for us, and I appreciate y'all being here. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right, well, let's get this show on the road. I know we got a little, you got somewhere to be.
Do.
I think somewhere out east, right?
Yes.
Very, very busy guy. So good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everyone to the City of Hopkinsville's Council Chambers for today's town hall. We are especially honored to be joined today by what I've heard described, he's been described as a Kentucky General Assembly legislative powerhouse, a Republican representing the Kentucky 16th House District, Mr. Representative Jason Petrie. Let's all please give him a round of applause. Jason, on behalf of Mayor J.R. Knight, the City of Hopkinsville, City Council, our team of public servants, and the City of Hopkinsville and Christian County, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. As we talked about earlier, we know that the state is currently in legislative session, and your days are filled with 1,000,001 meetings. As quickly as you have time opened up, like you said, you have another one. So we recognize you taking a moment to meet with your constituents as meaningful and bring us all closer to the democratic process. Let me take a quick moment to introduce myself. My name is Cody Nofsinger. I'm thrilled to facilitate today's discussion as the moderator. I'm a CPA by trade, currently serving as a controller of Hopkinsville Electric System and Energy Net. In addition to other past community service roles, I'm a member of the Christian County Chamber of Commerce Executive Committee, serving as a Workforce Education Development Chair. A few other things on my resume, but we will keep that for later because we've got time that we've got to get going. We have a little bit of that. But I fully believe in community advocacy and involvement, and therefore I'm looking forward to discussing the issues on the minds of the citizens of Hopkinsville and Christian County. So last but not least, I'd like to give a special thank you to those in attendance in person today and those tuning in virtually. An engaged and informed public is a vital part of a highly functioning government and its ability to serve the people of this great state. I hope you'll find today's discussion to be informative and that it helps shape your understanding of how the current work in the State General Assembly will affect Hopkinsville, the greater Pennyroyal region, the Commonwealth, and you personally. So now that we've gotten all the greetings and formalities and all the polite stuff out of the way, let's get down to business and let's learn a little bit more about our guests. I want to give you a little bit of a better introduction than I gave you. All right, so that for those of us who are not familiar with Jason Petrie, even though I know we all are, we'll know. So Jason Petrie was raised on a farm in Clifton, Kentucky, and is currently a resident of Elkton, Kentucky. He graduated from Todd County High School before attending Berea College, where he earned a BA in economics and philosophy. He continued his education at Western Kentucky University, receiving a Master's of Arts in Humanities for eventually earning his Juris Doctorate from the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. I was going to say, I have to say the Ohio State University and give you a congratulations on winning a national championship last night. I only say that not because I care that Ohio State won or not, but now they'll forget that they beat Kentucky in basketball a few weeks ago. I can say that as a proud University of Kentucky alum. So, passing the bar, Jason started his own private practice while also serving as a victims advocate and assistant Commonwealth attorney. Representative Petrie was elected as a Republican on the ticket for the 2016 Kentucky House of Representatives election. He serves the 16th district, including Todd, Logan, and parts of Christian County. He has since been reelected four more times, most recently in this past year's 2024 election cycle. Thank you to Wikipedia for all of that. Great. You keep it updated. So we have a great bio here. So he serves as the chair of the Appropriations and Revenue Committee, as well as on the Judiciary Committee, the Capital Projects and Bond Oversight Committee, and the Public Pension Oversight Board. He is often called the brains behind House Bill 1, commonly known as the Kentucky State Income Tax Reduction Bill, which we will talk about in length today. So, Jason, that's quite the resume. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, I have, except for I do have three children, all above the age of 18, thank goodness. One graduated college, an employed CPA firm. Wife, wonderful, about 30 years, coming this June the 3rd. I don't know how she's done it, but she has. She's awesome. And we have three roosters and eight chickens and one dog that we take care of at home.
Well, I'll be reaching out to Wikipedia to update your page. Chicken farmer. Yes. We'll put that on there. Whew, so, yep. Also, so thank you for sharing a little bit more about yourself, who you are personally. Can you tell us about your thoughts in the last 8 years and what it means to you to represent the citizens of the 16th District?
Yes. Good question, and not pie in the sky, not highbrow stuff. I will just tell you that coming in for this term, so we've been in, I came in the 16 election, the 17 session. Coming back into this one, I've had a lot of session days, a lot of meetings, a lot of everything going on. And still, the very first day of session, you come in and you get ready to take that oath. Walker knows this, Myron knows this. And you look in there with all the history and knowing what kind of decisions are going to be made and how impactful those decisions actually are on the ground in people's lives. It's one of those things almost like going to church in the good sense and going there not to go to sleep or not to think about something or else, but just to take in the magnitude. And it's an awesome responsibility, but it still takes my breath away when you get in there and you go, okay, this is something we have to take care of, everything for everybody the best way we can. Let's get to it. Let's do it. But it still catches you.
It's the hard work, but the good work, right?
It is. I mean, I don't know if any of you are actually from my district. Who's in the northeast quarter, aside from you? Northeast quarter. Northeast quarter. Ah, so I've got one. But I look at it as I have my district, I have the region, and we have the state. And so we look a lot for statewide policy. So everybody in here is a constituent to me.
You know he's from your district because he has that mustache.
That gives me away.
That's the style of the men up in the northeast corner, right? So I think it's a good segue. We kind of talked about some high-level things there, get to know you a little bit better, which I think is always great. But I think today we talk about, as I said, our topics of discussions are going to be Kentucky state budget and the income tax cut. So I'd like to get started today talking about House Bill 1.
Okay.
As noted for, most of your work is surrounded co-sponsoring House Bill 1, an act related to the individual income tax rate. It was originally introduced in 2022, and this rendition is passed this year, this legislative session. It will lead to a reduction in state income tax from 6% to 3.5% over that period. Can you give us some information on the details behind this bill and the journey to get it passed?
Yeah, so tax reform in Kentucky actually started about 2018, at least the individual income tax rate. Made some significant moves, went to a flat tax system. We had a slightly progressive tax system in Kentucky up to that point in time. And in 18, we just flattened it at 6, reduced it to 5, and did the same thing on the corporate side, made sure it was around 5. 22, there was House Bill 8, and that was set up to, okay, a little bit of post-COVID, we have a way with budget leading us. We have a way to bring down the individual income tax rate in Kentucky, and we can talk about why. But mechanics of it, set up a formula in House Bill 8 and 22 that does essentially two things. One, make sure we have enough reserves. So if you're going to be looking at individual income tax rate reduction in Kentucky, that is a big dollar figure mover as far as our budget revenues are concerned. So we want to make sure we have sufficient to fall back on and that we are actually putting money away and keeping our reserves healthy while we're looking at reducing taxes. Second thing is this, if you could go in brute force and just take the rates down, not real smart. So we developed a formula, reserves as well as the spread between what actual revenues are that come in as opposed to what actual expenditures go out, that spread has to be twice the amount in our budget cycle, has to be twice the amount of what a half point reduction would cost in revenue. So if on current numbers it was around $718 million a year, around $300 million and so million in a, for a half, that would be a full point, for a half point, if you're looking at those numbers, we have to have a full point spread, which is about $1.37 billion between actual revenues and actual expenditures. If we have that, then we're floating well enough with the reserves behind us to take that individual income tax rate down a half point. And that's the formula that's been set up that has worked a few times, and then we have one working this time. How do we certify that? You could say politically we're going to say, yes, the conditions were met. not the healthiest way to do that. So what we did is we directed the Office of State Budget Director to certify at the close of each fiscal year on about the first few days of September and let us know, according to their calculations, as they see actual revenues for the closed fiscal year and actual expenditures for the closed fiscal year, is that spread sufficiently to be twice the amount necessary for a half point over a full year. If they certify and say, yes, those two conditions have been met, you've kept enough reserves and your spread is large enough, then it's able to come back in front of the General Assembly for consideration, as it's doing in this session 25, of should we go ahead and reduce? And if we do, then we pass a bill and say half point down, make it effective the following year, as we have been doing. So if House Bill 1 this year were to pass, conditions were met, General Assembly passes out of the House and the Senate, becomes law, that would go into effect January 1 of 26 and reduce the rate to 3.5.
All right. Well, you just answered all my questions I had prepared today, so we can leave.
Good.
Now, I am really trying to reject the urge as a numbers guy to nerd out on that and get really down in the weeds. But we're gonna stay up at the high level. So you talked about the reserve account. Can you kind of just touch on that a little bit more in detail?
Sure. So anyone who has their personal finances or business finances, most likely you have a savings account, or at least you want to. So the state has a savings account called the Budget Reserve Trust Account. Some people call it the rainy day. That's just not accurate. It's a reserve account. So when we have good opportunities that present themselves, we have a reserve account from which we can push and make further investment. If something bad were to happen, like tornadoes or flooding, then we have reserves from which we can render immediate assistance. So in the good and the bad, that's what the reserve account is for. Now, historically in Kentucky, a reserve account has existed. But that's just about it. So it's existed, and if you look from about 2000 through 2016, there were about 4 years where the Commonwealth's savings account, the Budget Reserve Trust account, was in the negative about 4 years. I'm not sure how you have a negative savings account of any significant dollar figures, but it's not good. I know that. We're trying to make sure that there is renewed focus and energy put in on building that reserve account up, separate and apart from individual income tax rate reductions. Why? One, things happen. Tornadoes, flooding, earthquakes, God forbid, but there are things out there. And sometimes there are good things that come along and you want to be able to invest. It's also very, very, very good when you can build up that account, as we have done, built it up to around $5.5 billion. And then from that, we had House Bill 1 in the 2024 session, which released about $3.1 billion over a 2.5-year, 3-year spread, so that we can make one-time investments out into water, wastewater, roads, 501c3 activities, all kinds of stuff that are one-time investments. So it's not money that once it goes out to a particular activity or a capital project that you expected again, but were able to make those one-time investments. You can't do that without a Budget Reserve Trust account that's been built up to one of the best in the country and was one of the absolute worst in the country 5-6 years ago.
Thank you for all of that detail.
You can understand that none of your questions mean anything to me, right? They're topical.
Oh, I got plenty here. I got about 5 pages of questions. We could find some in this little bag of tricks I got in here. So, no, I'm just kidding. But a couple weeks ago, I was privileged to be present when you debated the bill on the House floor, and it passed 97 bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. So this is a bipartisan bill at the moment. And it's since had its second reading on the Senate floor and has been returned to the Senate Appropriation Revenues Committee. So what will be the process going forward to ultimately pass this bill to get us down to 3.5%? And is there any reason to believe it will not?
So I'm going to take those in reverse order. There's always a possibility something won't make it through, but there's really nothing that's indicating that it won't make it through this session. So the House did, we filed the bill, heard it in committee, reported it to the floor, had some amendments on it, dealt with that in regular process on the floor, and passed it 97 positive votes?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's 90. So 90 positive votes out of 100. Sent it over to the Senate, and their A&R that committee has already heard the bill and already reported back, technically, when it came out of committee, and so it is primed and ready to be considered by the Senate when they return February the 4th or February the 5th, I would think. or has been at least one amendment that I've seen. I looked at it yesterday, I think. One amendment, but I think the bill will move on through.
So that's kind of where we are today,
yeah.
where that sits.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there are some people who, I wouldn't say they're opponents to the bill, but they have expressed that we should exercise caution, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk about how this has been a systematic approach, but we've seen how in other states how this has gone. In 2012, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback sought to stimulate the state's economy by drastically cutting income taxes across the board. The initiative failed, and the Republican-controlled legislature had to reverse it. Consequently, the governor resigned. We've seen getting to zero in other states, such as Texas, Tennessee, and Florida, and how that's impacted them. But there was someone who was on the House floor during the debate. They said, we don't have oil, Dolly, or Mickey. How are we going to move forward? You know, you spoke about the triggers, but maybe on a high level, more of a macro level, of what are the things that are going to happen when we start getting lower than 3.5%, and we're going to have to start making a little more tougher decisions.
You don't think tough decisions have been made already?
Well, I didn't think, but it seems to have worked out.
I understand. So, individual income tax rate reduction can't be talked about without talking about the budget. He's like, do what now? Our tax reform could not have occurred without the General Assembly taking lead on the budget. Really, really quickly, in 2022 was the first time that the General Assembly, the House in particular, had filed a budget bill prior to the governor having released his version. And what had historically been the case was this. The governor and his staff, Office of State Budget Director and all of their people, would prepare a budget. And this is what happened when I started A&R in 21. They prepare it. Sight unseen, I'm asked to come downstairs and sign off on his bill. Sight unseen. Can I look at it? Nope. Can you give me a summary? Nope. So I just sign it. Yep. Okay. So out of civility, comedy to another branch, like, okay, do it. And then we get started. So it's the governor's recommendations under my name, and that becomes the budget bill for the executive branch. That happened in 21. In 22, for the first time in Kentucky's history, I filed the budget bill, all of them, the main one and all the other ones. That was a little kerfluffle with everybody, but the point is this, without having filed our own budget and taken control of what we had as priorities of what should be spent on and what should not, what goes to the back, what comes to the fore, and in what orders of magnitude with each one of those, we had little to no control over our budget because this is what happens. The governor comes out with his recommendation, sight unseen, I file it on his behalf. Now everybody sees it. And you, well, not y'all, all got something. And then those evil House members would have to come in and cut and paste and pull and reduce and increase and put new stuff in. Well, you can't put new stuff in because my stuff was in there. 22, we stopped that. And we said, look, we've had a considered lengthy process of what we think the budget should be. We follow it on our own, and then we move our own bill. We've passed your own bill, and we've done that ever since. Why do I say anything about that? Without that happening and us filing our own budget bills, we would never get to individual income tax rate cuts because, and the reform, because we have to make sure that we are seeing state government for what it is rather than what some want it to be. What it is limited state government with proper functions and no more than that. Not like the federal government that wants to be everything to everybody and write blank checks they still haven't paid for. We actually have to have a constitutionally balanced budget, and we need to make sure that we're not everything to everybody. It's limited state government. When you look at that budget and you start looking at it with those eyes, you actually see we've actually got more revenue coming in than we should have. You think, wow. There's three ways you can deal with it. Shh, don't tell anybody. And we spend it. Not a good approach. Second thing is, well, you don't want to give up that revenue because you might not ever get it back. And you never know what's going to happen in the future. So let's just give it back a little bit. anybody file income tax returns? If you did, then we will suck all the money up, and then we'll take a little portion of it and send it back to some of y'all with certain tax filings. Very inefficient, ineffective, and why just those people? So the third way, and what we opted for, is if you see that your revenue is coming in larger than what you need for limited state government, then reduce the revenues. Now, the first thing is you reduce revenues. Don't think statically, think dynamically. You reduce those revenues permanently by giving a tax cut. Now, you can do that in a lot of different ways, but if you give a tax cut on the individual income tax rate, then everybody who's out and working for wage or salary or otherwise is now encouraged to do a little more, and there's more left in their pockets so that they can spend it and use it according to their decisions in their local family, communities, and areas. And that's the beauty of doing budget that leads you to individual income rate tax reform.
So you've been quoted that you say that there's a lot of space in the budget in order to have these tax decreases. At some point, though, from 3.5%, the numbers will not necessarily...
They'll moderate.
They'll moderate. Mm-hmm. So what's the thought process if we... When we try to get down to 2%, let's say that,
sure,
you know, in that $600 million budget surplus, which I think I maybe have that number right, if I remember correctly. I may have it incorrect. My apologies. But from an article I wrote, I'll blame that on the Associated Press. But what I'm saying there is that at what point do you think that we will have to start looking at increasing revenues through possible other growth or other tax increases or reducing spending in order to continue to keep going to zero?
First, reduce spending. But it doesn't mean reduce programs that are out there. It's not reducing services. That's not what I have to talk about yet. And I don't know that we'll ever have to talk about it. As long as you have proper limited functions of state government, then you're doing what you're supposed to, and we'll fund it optimally. But there's still a lot of space in the budget to cut waste, to cut unnecessaries, to make things more efficient. You go, Petrie, there's no way that you can get that much money out of the budget. Come talk to me for a week or two, and I'll show you what I see, and you may have a different thought about it. There's a lot more to be cut, but the second part of it said don't think statically. When you reduce revenues, there is a growth factor that happens when that money gets invested back in the communities. In 18, when we cut, you see up. You don't see down. You don't see a reduction in revenue. How can you cut the income tax rate for individuals and still have increasing revenues? Well, we're investing in you. We're investing in Kentucky. We're investing in individuals. That brings business in. And this individual income tax rate reduction and the formula that we're going through and the way we're budgeting is not done in a silo. It's in the context of a lot of other things. So I don't know that you've gotten there yet, and I don't know that you're going to, but in 16 election, 17, we come in January the 3rd of 2017, the House majority switches and now matches what's in the Senate. There's some things that we did that very first week that there was a lot of heat over. Economic development. When you look at the close of 17, let's just say calendar years, not fiscal years, that'll help out on the discussion. When you look at that, this is what you see. From about 2000 through 2016, you're floating at about $2.2 billion worth of economic investment in Kentucky. There's a little blip up, little blips down, but it's a pretty tight banded range of about $2.2 billion from 2000 annually, 2000 through 2016. In 17, you'll see that go up three and a half fold. In 18, we stay up. 19, we're staying up. 20, we go back down to about $2.2 billion is what it turned out to be. 21, 22, 23, 24, we still go back up. Those economic decisions, those policy changes that were made at that point boosted us into another level, and we're still going. In addition to that, you take individual income tax return with investment coming in and leaving more money in people's pockets, you have additional growth that's taking place. It's not to say that COVID doesn't have its effects. All that massive spending at the federal level has effects. We can get into the good and the bad, but it has its effects. But do not take away from the fact of those changes made in 17 that bumped us up that year 3.5-fold in economic investment. which increases wages, which increases individual income tax. And just to give you an idea, in 2018, when we heard had the first rate reduction, so a full point at that point in time, cost about $993 million for individual income tax rate reduction of 1 point. Currently, as of August of 24, that same point reduction would cost you a little over $1.37 billion. Economic investment, you do have COVID effects in there, but the wages have continued to grow ever since 17. The economic investment has grown since 17. Has a lot to do with what's going on.
Thank you. Thank you for that answer. I guess, you know, so kind of because we're in discussion, I'm kind of flipping back here and forth in some of my questions. And so one of the key themes with your Democrat colleagues across the aisle, like I said earlier, they said their concerns that we should demonstrate caution moving forward. But another thought that they would talk about a lot, so you talked about spending, right? Mm-hmm. And keeping that and spending within our means. But one of the thought processes they have is that, are we actually making the necessary investments in our collective future? So how will we be able to continue to fund Medicaid, schools, other new initiatives, if we're using our budget surpluses to decrease income taxes and if we're not spending.
We are not using our budget reserves to reduce income taxes.
Let me rephrase that. My apologies.
It has nothing to do with it.
Okay. My apologies there. Yeah, that's not being done. But that excess capacity creates those triggers to where we can decrease those mm-hmm. income taxes. I should phrase it that way.
Yeah. I just want to make sure we're clear because it has nothing to do with it. It's a condition precedent, but it's not a sufficient condition to make it go down in and of itself. So those reserves sitting out there by themselves. As far as going down too fast or we've got revenue reductions, our revenues have continued to go up. So we'll stagnate in 25. I fully expect that. Maybe a slight increase, slight decrease, but we'll stagnate. 26 is still going up. If you look at the Commonwealth of Kentucky from 2004 or 6 through 2019, through 19 before we hit COVID, we're at about a 3.4% annual growth. Now, we've accelerated that with economic investment. There's been some acceleration off of COVID, but we're continuing to fund all services. Now, so I say you don't have to talk about programmatic cuts, but there are efficiencies that can be dealt with. If you look at, what about this current budget cycle? Look, we've got over $15.5 billion going into K-12 education. That's about 38.7 or 38.9% of our annual or biennial budget. You've got another almost 10% that goes out to higher education. You've got quite a bit going out into incarceration and a massive amount going into Medicaid at this point, expansion and traditional. We're continuing to fund these things, and we're looking at some programs to make sure they're not ballooning more than what they should be organically, like there's some other external or internal force making it speed up in expense. But these programs are continuing on, and the revenues are still there. We're not going backwards, but we are trying to adjust. Look, y'all's money is y'all's money, and the state shouldn't be taking any more of it than it has to render what's supposed to be rendered by the state. And the state doesn't render everything. Federal government renders a whole lot more, but it also takes up a whole lot more. But we're a limited government, and we have a constitutional requirement to stay budgeted. But when you look at what's happening, we are funding those things. We are funding what we've put priority on and we think are legitimate purposes of state government. And it's not a replacement mechanism. If you lose a dollar here, you've got to put a dollar in. People have got to get out of that mindset, and I hear it all the time. That's government thinking, and it has been around for a few good decades. You've got to think, what are we supposed to be doing? What does it actually cost? How do we build in efficiencies to it? And then we fund it that way. And then you're rendering what you're supposed to.
Oh, no, you're great. I kind of stay on the spending side and kind of move a little. I mean, all of this is interwoven. As you said when we were speaking before here, you can't talk about, you know, budgets without revenues, right? You can't do that. You also can't talk about you get budgets without the expense side as well. So in 2024, the General Assembly passed a two-year budget. And in a clip with WKDZ, you were speaking at a meeting, and you stated there was record investment in public education, higher education, unemployment insurance fund, economic development roads, transportation, water, other infrastructure. and that we currently have one of the best reserve accounts in the state, as you've noted previously in this town hall.
Mm-hmm.
So first thought is, and we reduce an income tax rate, people start thinking reduction in revenues, but we've been able to make investments in other ways, and how we've been able to do that.
Yeah. It goes back to budgeting, and I'm not trying to be overly simplistic, but it is, in some senses, it's like in your own house or your own business. You've got to go back to what you're budgeting. The first thing is, should you be spending money on it? K-12, yes. Public pensions, yes. Incarceration, yes. Medicaid, yes. Those are things that we need to be spending on. Reserve, building it, yes. Then you put focus on that. Everything else has less focus at that point. And look, let's just be very candid, okay? Do any of you think that in prior budgets, and I'm sure that I have identified in my own that I've been crafting, but in budgets prior to me being involved, over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, do you think in Kentucky there have been pet projects that have been put in there? Or pet programs that have been put in there? Or, I don't know, artisan centers on I-75 that cost crap loads of money because it helps somebody? There's a way station built in a certain place that we didn't need. There's pet projects. Anybody heard of pork? You don't think? Does anyone think that stuff wasn't in there before? It's a legitimate response. I'm just going to tell you, you're wrong if you think that. Okay, we have done our dead level best, at least since 21 and some before that, of quitting the accounting tricks, quitting the smoke and mirrors, and getting to actual honest budgeting that you do in your own house and your own business. And when you do that, you find all kinds of things that shouldn't be in there in the first place and should have been corrected a long time ago. There's a whole lot more to get to that I may not have found, because I'm finding it in the executive branch itself, not just in the pet projects out and about. For instance, one little bitty one. Has anybody in here ever heard of vacancy credits? Oh, come on. No one's heard of vacancy credits? Vacancy credits? Talking in round numbers, okay? Vacancy credits. Historical practice in Kentucky for budget. Governor releases his recommendation, signed, sight unseen. There are vacancy credits, and this spans all administrations. I'm not picking on anybody. This is not partisan yet. So this is just administrations, okay? Most recently, vacancy credits up of well over $100 million approached in $200 million. Well, $200 million, thereabouts, 180-something, I think is what it is. Well, what are there? What are you as taxpayers getting for these vacancy credits? Have any idea? Yeah, nothing. Yeah, so what happens is, and what has happened historically, is that budget recommendations become the budget bill, and there's a lot of vacancy credits in there. And what they do is this. The executive branch says, each agency reports what jobs they should have filled. Not what they do have filled, but what they want to or should have filled. So you may be in a particular agency that has 39 employees, but you're supposed to have 54. So you get credit for that excess so that if you could hire them there in the next 2 years, the money's available. Well, what I'm finding is we're never going up in numbers. Well, where's the money going? Up until this last budget cycle, when we kind of caught on to it a little bit better and was able to craft some good language, well, the executive branch had a way of liquidating those budget, those vacancy credits in a particular agency. Liquidating it becomes slush cash, and then moving it to somewhere where they wanted to do something. Their pet projects. Expand this, or create this, or change scope of this. And so we siloed that and said, nope, if you've got vacancy credits, you can't use them anywhere else, you can't liquidate and move, you can only liquidate and it sits. And then we cut some of their vacancy credits. They screamed, you're going to shut down agencies, you're going to cut services, you're going to do everything in the world. That didn't happen. And no, oh, you're going to fire people. Nobody was fired. You're going to lose your job. Nobody lost their job. But we shaved off 50, 60, 70 million. I'm somewhere in that ballpark just from that. Guess what? We've got more to go on that one. That's just one little bitty thing. That's a huge one, but that's a little bitty one when you get down to it. There's a lot more of that stuff in the budget to trim out so that your taxpayer money goes up and it goes back to services to you rather than getting waylaid into somebody else's wants and desires. Whether that used to be the General Assembly, we're trying to cut that out, do programs more than anything else, or the executive branch waylaying money.
Well, you just set the stage for my next question.
Wonderful.
You've talked a lot about spending reform, right?
Yep.
Trimming the fat, cutting that waste. What are some priorities with the General Assembly when we create those excess funds by reducing spending that you want to take those, redirect them, and what are some programs you do want to invest in?
Rarely do we get into an analysis of we want to cut this in order to get it somewhere else. We usually look, Myron and Walker would know that we've been in these conversations. If there's an item or an issue that we talk about it. And we start off with, is it proper for state government to be doing that? That's the first question we have to ask. If it is not, it's gone. If it is, then we go, okay, then what's its function? What's it supposed to be producing? Your money is being pulled up for that to give you something back. What is it supposed to give you back? Is it doing that or is it doing something else? Get it back on focus. And then at the same time, can it be done more effectively? So we look at every single piece of the budget that way to see if there is something that needs to be culled on its own, not in relationship to where we can take money from here and put it somewhere else. We just don't engage in that. On the question itself about where would we put priorities at, well, we're already doing that. K-12 education, we've continued to up that budget every cycle. We've continued to up the budget on public pensions. Don't know if anybody has anything to do with state pensions or C plans or anything else, but on the K side, on the state side, I started talking about this in 2010 or 12 just in law practice because our credit rating kept getting tanked and tanked and tanked because we weren't dealing with our public pensions. So we come in and we actually amortize the debt and go, how do you pay this sucker down? And it hurts. You're talking about the billions that we're putting in on pensions, but we've got to pay that debt down. Now I want to stop for those are priority things that we continue to work on. Medicaid, we continue to work on the waivers, in-home waivers, all kind of higher education, we continue to work on that. Making sure that we're trying to reduce the debt load for students that come through the higher education system, make sure that people coming out of high school are ready for the higher education, all those type things. We continue to put priority on there. As far as new priorities, those are the most dangerous because the first thing you've got to do is really have a public policy discussion here and everywhere else is that a proper function for state government? Everybody love puppies? Got a great big program for puppies. Cost $210 million a year. It's going to take care of puppies in Kentucky. Puppies will be happy, they'll be well fed, and they will live long and happy and productive lives as puppies and adult dogs. Everybody in favor? It's just $210 million. Come on, raise your hand. How could you be against puppies? First question you got to ask is, you've got to ask the first question, which is it a proper function of state government to take care of all puppies in the Commonwealth? Sunk tax money from everybody and take care of all puppies. Insert subject matter that you so choose. And the same questions have to apply, and the same question is going to come back to me and everybody. How could you be against that? Well, because we don't have unlimited funds, we're not going to put ourselves in tremendous amounts of debt. We're going to make sure that whatever money comes from taxpayers, including me and you, is used effectively and efficient to render services back that have some kind of value to you and do so efficiently and effectively. Efficiently and effectively. And if nothing else, we'll make sure those services come back to you efficiently and effectively. Because if it's coming out of your pocket, you ought to be getting something back and not have a lot of waste at it. Hope that helped.
I appreciate that answer. I do want to go back to something you said. When you say creative accounting, you looked straight at me whenever you said that.
What was it again?
When you said creative accounting, you looked straight at me when you said that. And I was like, okay, man. No, I'm just kidding. But we're gonna kind of wrap up the talk on House Bill 1 and state budget, move into a more broader conversation about economic development, especially in the region. But I want to end with one question there, or maybe let you give a statement. This is kind of the philosophical side of the debate with going to 0% income tax.
Yeah.
You know, Representative Nemes, he had an impassioned speech on the House floor. He talked about From 6% to 3% saved Kentuckians, families, about $1,500 a year. You can extrapolate that back. It'd be closer to, you know, a little bit over $3,000 to get to 0%. And then others will say that it's a regressive tax in nature, that it benefits higher income earners versus lower income earners. And there's a possibility, though you've eloquently stated why that should not happen with the triggers, but it might create some opportunity for reduction in spending to help in those populations. So on that broader philosophical standpoint, what would be kind of your stamp answer or feelings on that, I guess?
If I'm catching the question right, it's a normal response to reduction of a rate on tax. So it's the individual income tax rate. It's not corporate. It's individual income tax rate, the rate. If you were to stand on this foot and go, yes, at the end of the day, someone who makes $100,000 that gets a half a percent cut in absolute dollars will get more than somebody that makes $1,000 and has a half a percent cut. That's math, people. So if that's the issue, then good gosh, I don't think we can do anything anymore, to be honest with you, because that's just math. But if you cut the rate for somebody making $100,000 and somebody making $1,000 from 5 to 4.5 to 4 to 3.5, everybody's enjoying the same rate cut, almost. On straight math, you are. But now think about this. Regressive, progressive tax. I'm not going to take a stance on it. Everybody kind of has an idea of what that means. But let's be real about what was in Kentucky prior to 2018 when we flattened the tax. So really, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, somewhere 5.8 for anybody that made over $8,500 to close to $100,000. And then it was 6% anybody over that. That's not much of a progression. So let's not fool ourselves that that's what we had before. We just flattened it at 6. It was 5.8 for a vast bulk of people, and then we try to move that on down. And I almost got caught on the accounting side. But think about this for a moment. We flatten, we pull it down. It's fair to everybody on the rate reduction. And I say almost. Absolute dollars versus everybody's getting the same rate decrease. But here's an interesting context to think about. So your higher earners get more absolute dollars, same rate reduction, but how many of them at high dollar figures are engaged in K-12 public education? At higher earners, how many of them are involved in Medicaid expansion or traditional? Higher earners, how many of those are involved in a lot of other programs that we deal with? Their involvement is a lot less, number one. Number two, we're already set up in Kentucky on our tax code rate, as well as other standard deductions and so forth and so on, ballparkish rule of thumb. If you're $28,000, you're not going to be paying anything in anyway, and you're likely going to get a refund from state and or federal. So you've got the lowest socioeconomic class that, well, they're not getting as many dollars in absolute as those that make more money. They're just getting the same rate cut. Yeah, but they're also receiving so much more from everybody else that is getting that rate cut in absolute dollars. They're helping fund all of their other activities, whereas the ones that are paying that more absolute dollars aren't getting much of anything back. Now, does that mean we should change it? No. But we have to be cognizant of it. It's not just, oh, absolute dollars. If you make more, you're getting more. Well, absolute dollars, yes. Rate, yes. It's exactly the same. But the lower down on that economic scale you are, the more you're benefiting from everybody else's tax dollars coming to help you out in some way, somehow. And I'm not saying we shouldn't, but it is there and we have to recognize it. It's not so easy just to go absolute dollars or rate. You got to think about what the whole system is doing. And when you talk about K-12, you're talking about 38 point high, almost 40% of our budget, general fund. When you're talking about higher education, more affluent, probably not receiving keys and all the scholarship monies for need-based. That's another 10% of our budget. That's going to put us right up in the 50% budget realm. Then you add in Medicaid, that's going to get us up in the 60-65% range. incarcerations. Sorry, people, but you can look at the demographic information there, and it's not higher income that is filling up prisons for incarceration costs. It's just not there. So you're starting to eat up a whole lot of the budget that we have that's going to help people that may need it, but they're also not paying into the system in the same amounts that everybody else is. This seems like an entirely fair income tax rate reduction, especially for, look, you could give back a sales tax rebate. What's that going to do to the economy? Makes things less expensive, maybe. But it doesn't encourage production. It doesn't encourage work. It doesn't encourage, I can go out and get something and do something and make something, and I get to keep more in my pocket. We're trying to encourage more of that and encourage people from other states to come in and take part of that for population purposes and workforce.
Thank you.
Yep.
So we're going to spend a few minutes here before we open up the floor to some questions, talking about economic development, especially in this region. So in Governor Andy Beshear's State of the Commonwealth address and his speech at this month's Kentucky Chamber Day dinner, he noted the record-breaking economic development wins that we have experienced across the state these past few years. Just in your district, we've seen, according to the Southwestern Kentucky Economic Development Council, in the last 5 years, $2 billion in investments, over 2,000 jobs, just recently announced 925 jobs with Kitchen Food Company coming and purchasing the spec building in our industrial park. Personally, you've been recognized multiple times by the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce with their MVP award, receiving the ceremonial Louisville Slugger for going to bat for business. So I've seen you receive that a couple of times, actually. I know you have multiple of those. What do you believe is contributing to this period of economic growth, and how do we continue to move forward doing so in the future?
One of them, I'm going to go back to changes we made in 17 and made this much more business-friendly for put your economic investment in Kentucky. Number two, we have put a great lot of value and effort into how do we get higher education better and K-12 education better for workforce, not only four-year degrees, two-year degrees, and certifications. Get that workforce in. Thirdly, and this is something people don't see a great lot, but infrastructure supports. So when you talk about rail, you talk about river, you talk about roads, you talk about water, wastewater, internet, I'm losing fingers, internet, natural gas, on down the line, we have in the last several years placed more investment into those areas than the Commonwealth, and I'm speaking without knowing exact numbers, but more than the Commonwealth ever has, not anywhere close in anything I've looked at. And even this last round in House Bill 1 from last year, the investments out of the reserve account, I mean, $3.1 billion over almost a three-year period, but you've got $750 million additional on roads going out. Those are public highways. You've got almost $500 million going on water, wastewater, assistance to cities, assistance to counties and projects that they have. You've got some massive help. We've also developed a waters program. It's actually W Waters program. We put in, I think it's $75 billion 1 year and $75 the next, and developed a program for those water and wastewater districts that can't find financing through the USDA or through the state's ABF funds that are federally involved. This is state money that we're using and created our own fund. We've also put in, I can't even keep count at this point, how many tens of millions, and we're well over 100, maybe in the 200 million mark at this point, of what's called a product development initiative, where we have developed a scoring system depending on how fast your population's going up, what your absolute population is per square mile, what your median incomes are, and we've put people in tiers, and we have really, four or five tiers, and we have really focused money to go into investment for economic development. Carter will know all about PDI, and we've gotten PDI in all the areas around here so that money's invested from the state, from these new programs, so that you can have spec buildings, you can have infrastructure support, you can have all the things that go into industrial parks. All the things that go into having something where in counties that don't have anything at all so that they can start to say, hey, come here. We can have you here as a business and grow with you. We've developed all kinds of programs like this on infrastructure and economic development and on and on and on. And they're all, and the grant program that was just done in 23 and 24, another $200 million that's going out of House Bill 1. And it's all stacked toward less populated, less growing areas. We're not looking at trying to make sure the Golden Triangle becomes platinum. We're trying to make sure that the rest of the state comes along and it's just as golden. And that's what we've been developing. We've gotten away from the earmarks. We've gotten away from the pork. We've gotten away from the special projects and developed programs to help that development across the state. And this area is benefiting from it, and all, well, across the Commonwealth it is.
Great. I appreciate the response. You answered quite a few of my questions in regards to rural underserved areas and this region in particular, especially with infrastructure, was kind of where I was going next. So I like to think I led you there.
You did.
So let's also continue to talk about economic development, and let's talk about workforce, right? Talking about getting more people into the workforce. Our Kentucky labor force participation rate is 57.4%, which is ranked as the seventh lowest nationally. We talk about broadening that base when you talk about the income tax going to zero. What are some initiatives that the General Assembly can support to encourage or make possible for more Kentuckians to enter the workforce?
Yeah, and I've talked about this in Hopkinsville before in a different group. We have focused on return out of incarceration. So as you're coming out, you've served 1, 3, 5 years, whatever, or more, to encourage and reduce liabilities for potential employers. We've got all kinds of substance abuse. Just got my monthly report about how many beds that we don't have full, so we have excess capacity to make sure we're getting substance use disorders. We've pushed in just about every way. Expungements. I ran a bill when I was judiciary chair, drafted it, ran it, put it through Bratcher, biggest thing we'd ever done on expungement, and we're trying to get all of the impediments, I'll just leave it at that, impediments to somebody that wants to get back into the workforce to be able to get back. KCTCS on skills training, GEDs, higher education, make sure we've got money to help people if you can come back out, and try to expand these programs so they apply to people that may have a felony or misdemeanor on their record, on and on and on. And we see improvement, but the stat that you're citing is pretty close. But now here's an interesting piece. Within the last 6 months, I was looking at labor participation rates. And yeah, we're generally about 10 points lower than the nation. And I go, okay, this is a cultural thing. There's a cash economy and people that are subsisting rather than working and growing and investing in themselves and in their families. And I still think I'm there. And I don't know how to, I don't know what to do at this point. I say enlist the help of cities and counties, but mainly I'd say enlist the help of every church that's out there and every member that can get to talk to somebody that lives next door to them and say, work is a great thing. Work is a great thing. Guess what? There's all kinds of studies that say work lends to better health physically, mentally, economically, better on holding marriages together, better on having kids at an upper status, better for them for on pregnancy issue, drug issue, educational issue, suicide issue, and on down the line. There's almost nothing that speaks against it. But I will point out on your stat, there's an oddity that I've come across. There's about 12 counties, eastern part of the state, that if you were to take them out of the equation, Kentucky's about within 2 points of the national average. So when I look at, let's get solipsistic and just look real quick, Christian County. What's that labor participation rate? Well, let's just look at Todd County. Just look at Trigg County. Just look at. There's about 12 that is really pulling that average down and has been doing this for a while. East Kentucky, they have their own special set of circumstances, and I mean that because their economies are different, their history is different, their infrastructure is different. It is different. But we have been trying to seed things there, the PDI programs and other things, the infrastructure, the water, oh my gosh, trying to get things in to help seed, root, so that we can stop the population slide, keep people there. Healthcare is doing well. Education's doing pretty well there. But we've got to get some other industries developed. The topography's difficult there. Also, the geography, But our labor participation rate in Kentucky is really not that bad, and we're really close to national average, but for about 12 counties. How we're going to crack into that, I'm not sure. We've tried a lot of things, but I think the first thing is just trying to diagnose the problem rather than trying to figure out what's wrong with West Kentucky. West of I-65, what do we do to get more people working? What do we do to get between 65 and 75? We got to get more people working. I'm not sure that it properly identifies what the issue is. I think where your biggest bang for your buck on your energy investment is, let's look at those 12 counties, try to identify what circumstances are there that are keeping that participation rate extraordinarily low, and let's work on that. Not sure about it yet.
You know, one barrier to workforce participation, and it's a massive burden on Kentucky families, is the lack of quality, affordable child care. Mm-hmm. You know, as a father of almost 2-year-old, this definitely hits home in the Knopfinger household. Universal pre-K has been spoken by many elected officials as a solution. Others have talked about other possible solutions. Is addressing the child care shortage a priority for the General Assembly? And what solutions do you see being an actual possibility to help work on finding a solution for that issue?
Okay, so make sure we understand sarcasm first, okay? Well, of course, the Commonwealth of Kentucky can take over the child care industry and just foot the whole bill for everything across the Commonwealth, right? Sarcasm. Is it the proper function of state government to be doing that? Be supportive. Don't hurt. Yes and yes. But that's a market function. And it strikes me as odd if it's so important to so many families, and we already chunk in tens of millions of dollars to help the economically disadvantaged to be able to afford child care. If it is such a high priority, then why do we not have people willing to get into the business? Is it because they have too much administrative overhead and they can't run a business model on it? Because the revenue is too iffy and they can't get from week to week or month to month? Is it because there's too much zoning restriction from where they can be at? Do they need a public-private partnership, a P3, to assist with it? We have some bills in the work that may make it through this session and some other things that will be coming that will be assistive, but we should not, this is not a proper function for state government to be taking your children voluntarily in and go, we have daycares in 120 counties, and all you've got to do is sign them up and send them in and we'll pay for it. That's not a proper function of state government. Now, we will try to assist, and we will continue to support the way we have in lower economic areas to help. But you also have to even look, what kind of problem is there with child care? Look, my kids are not that old, and I remember going through child care. It's an issue. It's a real issue. But you have employers, and we have a program that's already up and going and has been for 2 or 3 years where the state, supportively but not taking over the industry, in addition to helping out those that are economically disadvantaged, we're matching up to a very large dollar figure with employers of certain sizes that can do it. If they have a benefit of child care to the employees, then we will match up to a certain fee, which is pretty high in my opinion. So we're willing to help support, but this needs to be a market-driven solution. Why didn't the county take it over? What about the city? Why don't you take it over? Yeah, the state shouldn't be doing it either. Don't hinder. Be supportive. Help those that truly can't afford what's in the market itself. But that's not something for the state to take over. And I may have missed part of your question that came after that. Sorry.
No, sir. I believe you answered it. Okay. I'm going to do one more question on our economic development portion of this, and then we'll open up to a few questions. We're doing great on time here. Better than I expected, to be honest.
Very good.
So one of the questions is, we've had a group that has been advocating in our community for, an income tax exemption for retired military. What are your thoughts on this policy, and what other initiatives do you think that we can do in the Commonwealth to help recruit more retired service members to live in the Commonwealth, which obviously hits very home to us here in Christian County?
Yeah, so there's already, I can pull out a list and give you all the benefits that already accrue to active as well as veteran, inactive, military. I know the issue in Christian County is more focused on, well, what about retirement and past exemption of 31-1? That's an income tax over and above the 31.1. What have we been talking about? Flattened it at 6, reduced it at 5, 5 to 4.5, 4.5 to 4, and we're trying to get to 3.5. And guess what? Whether you're military, whether you're a retired teacher, whether you're a retired state worker, whether you're a retired county worker, regardless of whether you're a retired city worker, regardless of whether you're retired just because you're retired and you have limited income coming in from whatever retirement you may have, as we go to zero, everybody gets it. So military, respect them, love them, appreciate their service, got them in my family. Yes, 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 and yes. And we already exempt out incomes. We already provide a lot of benefits. I think it's better if we have all boats rising on this one at one time rather than picking a special group out here, because as soon as I, and it would be the House that has to do it on revenue, as soon as I put a bill out that does anything on that one group to reduce what revenue's coming in on them, I will have a Me Too line right behind them of 67.5 people saying Me Too. I'm an EMS worker. I'm a nurse. I'm a police officer.
I'm an accountant.
I've never had that one in line, but sure, sure. So you've got people that, they render great service to all of us. Great service to all of us. Let's try to get them all down to zero rather than just one and letting the Me Too line come behind.
Thank you again for your response on that question. Diane asked that maybe we'd open it up if some individuals in the audience had questions. Sir here already has his hand raised.
No, George. What you got?
We know that.
Yeah, it is a hot, sexy topic right now, all things housing. It has been for a year or two. And so you can look at different numbers and say something like we're about 200,000 units short in Kentucky, whatever that means. You get the definitional problems at that point. And I don't know where that 200,000 is located at. So you get into that. So the real question becomes this. Surprise. Should state government be involved in it in the first place? Is it a proper function of state government? So are we supposed to build everybody's houses for them now? No. Are we supposed to pay for everybody's houses now? No. Can't afford either one of those, actually. Even with a good reserve, you can't do that. So what do you do? Well, be supportive and try not to hurt. Okay. Well, try not to hurt. We are looking at and have been looking at zoning ease-ups so that they're not overly restrictive. We've also, I have, and so I'll take whatever arrows are coming, that's fine, online, wherever. I've also cut out all conversations from an A&R perspective of, well, let's subsidize the buyers. Let's give them some money so that they can afford. We've cut that out because all it's going to do is up the prices and we'll spiral worse on inflation. We'll have even less units moving. So really where we've been focusing at is on the supply side. The zoning can help make sure it's not overly regulated. We're working through a bill with a group right now, trying to work through, and I don't want to get into great detail about it, but basically set up a development district at the local level, not at the state level, so that a county or a city or both can engage in a development district for housing and say, this is the type of housing that we're talking about, and a way to grant money back to developers from real estate tax base to build that on a very performance time base. So it encourages if a city or a county can go, look, in this particular area over here, we have sewer, we have water, we have broadband, we have electric. It wouldn't cost us $40 million for a subdivision to pop up over there or development to pop up. Locally, you can look at it and go, this is a prime area for us. That can be designated as a development district. And then over a short period of time, by contractual obligation, developer could come in or developers could come in under contractual restraints and performance markers and make sure these units get built out in a short time frame so that it gets turned over, increases real estate values, which helps everybody. and increases the capacity of what we have to offer as far as housing. Now, housing in Todd County, which isn't that far away, housing in Christian County, housing in Fayette County, and in Jefferson County, and in Boone County, and in Pike County, and in every other county in the Commonwealth, appears to be very different. Very different most of the time. So at the state level, I don't think we should be telling Christian County, okay, you can build a $31,000 house at 400 square feet, but that's it. Don't know that that's going to hit your market. So what we're trying to do is give maximum flexibility to the locals, cities, counties, ease up their time frame for working through zoning and other permitting issues, not to cut safety, but this stuff is going to be very public if it's a designated development area already. Truncate that so we can get some contracts, we can get people moving, and they can get their finance packages moving, and that in part will be spurred by a real estate portion coming back to them on taxes over a very short amount of time. That's one of the things that we're working on. I'm hopeful that we'll get it through this time. There are rehabilitation tax credits, which is another one, and this is very much for y'all, so I'm going to go ahead and give a PSA real quick. Historic tax credit for buildings in Kentucky. Kentucky already has a long-standing program for this. You get a tax credit. Commercial, residential. You take older buildings, you rehabilitate them, and you get a big tax credit or a nice tax credit. How old, Mr. CPA, does a building have to be in order to qualify for a rehabilitation tax credit?
I got out of the tax business a long time ago.
Anybody know? Come on. Nope. 50 years. Anybody here own a house older than 50 years old? You should have known this a while ago. So there's a system in place about the rehabilitation tax credits and how they're split between commercial, that's a definitional issue, and residential or commercial residential. But think about downtown Hopkinsville. Think about downtown any city around. It's an easy thing to think about. And think about that building that's been sitting there for a while that's really historic looking. It has some age to it, probably more than 50 years. Really not a lot being done with it, though. Okay, so you can have somebody that wants to come in and make it into a hotel and a business or a manufacturing facility or a retail establishment, but you could also have somebody that comes in and says, we want the first floor to be retail and we want the other three floors to be residential. What were you talking about earlier about the housing issue? We had about 200,000 units in the state that's down.
You said that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so this is another way to get some of those unit numbers up by rehabilitating existing buildings rather than finding a development district and building new houses from scratch and utilities to make sure they're connected. This is another piece of the pie to get to those existing buildings and retooling those for residential and commercial. There's a bunch of stuff on that one. Anyway.
Jennifer?
First of all, thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. It's part of what I'm supposed to do, I think.
Exactly. So you mentioned that daycare, when we think of daycare as sort of just babysitting, is not a proper function for state government. But more specifically, I didn't hear you address universal pre-K.
Good. Thank you, Marina.
When I say universal pre-K, I'm talking about care for 3- and 4-year-olds, it's not just babysitting.
Perfect.
But that has an educational component. What's your opinion on that, and do you see any link between that and economic development in terms of getting people into jobs?
Yeah, so not in any particular order, but universal pre-K. Do we already have pre-K in Kentucky? Yes, we do. How much does it cost every year for partial pre-K? A little over $83 million. That's about what it's in for people of special need that have some developmental delay or something other to make sure that they're brought up to speed. We're about 83, 85, maybe a little more than that million a year. Universal pre-K would say everybody, regardless, doesn't matter whether you're high 99th percentile or 42nd percentile in performance or impediments. Everybody's got universal pre-K. It's just part of the K-12 system at that point, and the state pays for it. Education at a young level, yes. Generally good, and generally good for K, and usually good for 12, and usually good for beyond. It's a good setup. It's a good system. It's good for workforce. It's good for a lot of things. But when you think about universal pre-K at our public education school districts, who in here has ever had a job? Seriously. Seriously. If you don't raise your hand, I'm going to really call you out. Ever had a job? Okay. And your job normally calls for you to have been at work or be on duty 8 to 3, Monday through Friday, never on weekends, never on a holiday, and never in the months of June or July and part of May and part of August, correct?
I'm in the wrong job.
I think I am also. Yeah. So universal pre-K education, let's leave that off to the side. Early learning, let's leave that off to the side. As far as being a daycare provisioner for people who engage in work and reducing an impediment for them to join in the workforce, I just don't see it. And no one's ever been able to explain it or even get it close, because schools, our schools, unless you want to make them all year long and have them open on holidays and on weekends somewhat, but at least Monday through Friday when the rest of the world is, and not taking off the same days and making sure that the 3 months in the summer are not there, the 2.5, and the fall break, the spring break, the Christmas break, the Thanksgiving break, and all that other stuff doesn't happen, then it's not available when workers, normal workers, need them to be available. And it's never workable for a second or third shifter. So I'm going to give you a particular example in Logan County. You ever heard of Logan Aluminum? Used to be Anaconda a long time ago. So it's been around decades. They've always been swing shift. Every 6 weeks, Logan Aluminum proper, every 6 weeks, they've got a new schedule, first, second, and third shifts, and everybody swings. They change. Universal pre-K would help them none. It's just not available. So we have to support some kind of child care. Don't hurt, and support, don't take over, child care. Now, a better child care than just, hey, here's a spot, here's food, and here's rest, would be some kind of educational component to that. All in favor of that. So early learning, we'll call that for the moment. Early learning, great. We have teachers in our public school districts that are early learning teachers. Take somebody special to deal with somebody that young and know what they're doing and do it effectively. Why can we not utilize those teachers into private child care to deliver early learning services? There's nothing that prevents it. And the child care service is going to have its hours based on its local market, and we can have early learning come out from the school system. Or if locally it just works better that the daycare delivers the child to the school system for a certain amount of hours to get that early learning component, okay. But as far as universal pre-K being a workforce solution in that sense, I just don't see it. Should we have some kind of educational early learning component in the traditional understanding of child care? Yes, great. All in favor of developing that. Heretofore, I've not had many people, if any, that are interested in working on that solution. It seems to be universal pre-K or nothing. I said I see a benefit educationally for early learning services. You say universal pre-K. I didn't say that part. Yeah. Good question, though. Appreciate it.
We'll open it up for one more question. Representative Petrie needs to get on the road here shortly, if anybody has one.
But. Sure.
No, Lee.
I won't put you on the spot and put you at odds with leadership, but probably about a year ago, if you pay attention to this sort of thing, we had an event here locally where nobody in the legislature but somebody who's in a leadership position in the state hinted at, you folks down there in West Kentucky on the Tennessee border, you might need to get comfortable with being at 3% or maybe getting to 2.5%. Getting to 0 is going to be really hard. And then when we heard President Stivers and the speaker maybe about a year ago, we heard sort of similar types of things coming out of their mouths. And now, since then, maybe there's been a little bit more enthusiasm about trying to get to zero. Cody and I were there the day you guys passed, and it was really exciting, and Jason Nemus gave a really good speech about it. What would your advice be for those of us in the room who would like to see Kentucky get to zero in terms of messaging to leadership, messaging to other people around the state to build the will to get there? Because it's going to take some tough decisions to be able to get to zero.
Yeah, good question. The formula that we put in place in 22, back to something you said earlier, I've used this in a lot of different settings. Louisville is one of the places I love to use it. It's like a tractor pull. That formula is like a tractor pull. And anybody's familiar with that, what happens as you go along, that load gets closer to you and it gets a little higher. And guess what? You're going to lose traction, most likely. You're going to have to reset, go back, get the tread right, reset, look at another part of the track, and head down again and see if you get better luck at it. In 22, before this was passed, I started talking about it in that sense, because nothing stays still. Revenues don't. The types of revenues don't. The economy doesn't. The world doesn't. Our expenditures don't. We don't have any control over tornadoes and flooding and other things that may occur. We have other things that pop up. So the whole equation is always moving. As I and my staff look out 3, 5, 7, 15 years out of what we think is likeliest to happen, there's going to be a spot where we have to reset, whether that's budget, formula, combined, something else we haven't even put on the radar yet. It's likely going to happen. So as you go from a state that was 46% or more dependent on individual income tax revenue down to one who right now has more sales tax revenue than it does individual income tax revenue, and we're continuing to go that route, it gets harder and harder. 46% of, let's just say, $10 billion back when. We're at $15.5 billion now. $4.6 billion out of $10 billion was coming from individual income tax. You going to cut that off in a day? No. And as circumstances change, will that formula have to be adjusted? It may. But I go back to, more than anything else, it's going to have to be a commitment to budgeting. It will have to be a real commitment to budgeting, starting with what actually is a proper function of state government. And everything else has to be cut. Eliminated, reduced, weaned, ultimately cut. It's not fair to anybody that's paying taxes in to do things that we shouldn't be doing in the first place. You do that, that's step one, and that takes commitment over many, many years and many, many budget cycles. It can't be done on a dime. It's a $15.5 billion budget. The executive branch budget is about 350 pages. I feel it painfully. It is pithy. It's like a scientific journal with cross-references. It doesn't make common English sense whatsoever, and most of it is in the base. What's in the base? You know what's in the base? Yeah, nobody does. It's all in the base. It's been there forever. Trying to dig deeper and deeper into that and get into the budget, that budget leads what kind of money we have available for the spread. It leads the entirety of individual tax reform, rate reform. Why do I bring that up? You ask, how can you support? Anybody that agrees in part or full with what I'm talking about, make sure you're talking to Myron, Walker, Craig. Talk to me if you want to me, leadership, anybody else you come in contact with in the General Assembly, and ask them to remain committed to a proper budget. Now, I say a conservative budget. Preserve the things that are working. You cut the things that are not, and you're always looking to do something better. Looking to the base, looking to the proper functions of government, that's going to take just a lot of nasty hard work that nobody ever gets credit for, but it leads the entirety of everything else that we've talked about today. Encourage people to continue that path. So far up to now, the General Assembly, Senate and House both, have bought into that, have agreed with that, have continued with that, even to the vote that we had just earlier in January. And now we even have bipartisan support for reducing the individual income tax. Trust me, that has not happened before. Trust me, there was nobody that wanted that formula that had been put in place. Nobody thought you could ever budget anything starting in 18 all the way to now. They were going to lose everything, and the world was going to fall off a cliff in Kentucky if we did any of this, and none of that's happened. Commitment to the budgeting is where it starts and where it ends. And I have said on the record before, and I will say it again, the moment the General Assembly, because it acts collectively, it's not just me, not Myra, not Walker, not anybody, or just a little group. It's not. It's the General Assembly. And the moment the General Assembly takes its foot off and takes its focus off and takes its energy off and takes its commitment off to budgeting properly, to proper state functions, then House Bill 1s are gone, rate reductions are gone, one-time investment monies of billions are gone, the reserve account will be gone in short order, and you'll be back to pork, line items, who do I know, and what favor can I get done? And it makes me sick, and I feel it right now, even to think about going back to that. We have done our dead level best to get rid of it. It's nasty. I hate it. I abhor it. Still fight stuff of it today. I do not want the Commonwealth to go back to that. And apparently the credit rating agencies don't want us to go back to it either, because we've had 3-4 upgrades, which hadn't happened in how long? Decades? And it's because we're getting back to honest budgeting. We're getting back to the things we're talking about, and we're making the investments, and we're still looking at the pensions and our services and our obligations and still cutting taxes and building reserves, and we're doing it the best way we can. So commitment to that budget is where you can lend support. Call your family, call your friends, call your enemies, and have everybody give support to continue working on the budget. Get it right.
That was a good question, Lee. I was going to end today of asking you what your thoughts and vision of the future of the Commonwealth, but I think you just shared with us very impassioned there what you think are the steps ahead, what's to come, and your opinions on what we should be doing to get there. I really want to appreciate your time spent with us today. I know you got to get on the road to get to Frankfort here very shortly. As we said, we know you have 1,001,000 meetings, and if you have a little time opened up, that might add 2 or 3 onto your plate. I also want to give a special thank you to Mayor Knight, all of our elected officials who attended today as well, the staff here at the City of Hopkinsville for helping to plan this. And most of all, again, I want to thank you, Representative Jason Petry, for taking time to visit with us. So good luck in this year's legislative session.
If I may say something real quickly, okay?
I'll let you have the last word.
If I may. Thank you. I appreciate it. Look, I mean, this is generally, you can ask anybody that's around me, I don't blow smoke. I don't embellish. I get right to it, and that's the end of it. But I want to tell you this. We talk about the budget, and we talk about everything that's going on. It's not for me. It's not for anybody in the General Assembly. Some of this stuff, we'll never even see it come to fruition and all the fruit that will come from it. We just won't. We will not. When pensions are dealt with in 47 or 49, I have no intention of being around at that point. We're trying to reduce the tax load. We're trying to get the proper services with the proper functions of state government because we believe in y'all. And trust me, this is not smoke blowing. This is honest down to the gut of it. We believe in y'all. We believe that each one of you have your ability to make good decisions. Not that you will every time, and I don't either, but that you have the ability to do it, and you're in a better position to do it than anybody standing or sitting or thinking in Frankfort. And the more that we can leave in your pockets to make your decisions with. If you're getting $100 a week and Frankfort takes 40 of it, a hot term today is agency. We just reduced your agency. Okay? You don't have the ability to do things. We're trying to reduce that burden and get that budget right. All the things we talked about so that each one of you have the maximum amount, optimal amount, left with you for you to make your decisions based on your circumstances, and that you can do that far better than any of us in the General Assembly can. So this is the thing. I'm just asking you, do the best with it you can. It's $1.37 billion per point that's being left in Kentuckians' hands every time that rate comes down a full point currently. We've already gone from 6 to 5 to 4 and about to go to 3.5. That's billions left in everybody's pockets across the Commonwealth. Guess what? It doesn't do anything if you don't do something with it. Invest. Make your decisions. But do it well, and you will do it better than this. We are doing these things because we don't think we need to take care of you. and keep your agency from you and keep your abilities from you and your authorities from you. We want to give it back to you. We want you to prosper and do the best that you can under your circumstances. And we will help those that can't and those that are disadvantaged. We will still continue to look for that. But the rest of it is going back. We're investing in you. Everything we're doing, we're investing in you. Please do well with it. Thank you.
Before we leave here today, Mayor Knight, would you like to say a few words to dismiss us?
Thank you, Mr. Petrie, for everything you said today. Thank you for being here. Cody, appreciate you doing an excellent job as usual on that. Thank you, each and every one of you, being here in the audience today. We appreciate the questions that we've had, and we appreciate you, and you have a good evening. Thank you.